From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll hear about the rise in neighborhood watch groups across Oakland.
We don't want to put anybody in harm's way or in jeopardy. We don't want anybody thinking that they're the police. We don't want anybody thinking that they're, you know, any vigilante justice or anything like that.
Then we'll hear how a diverse group of black men respond to this question.
This may seem like a silly question, but I want to know, am I the only one who has problem eating chicken, watermelon, and bananas in front of white people?
And what happens when radical artists reimagine San Francisco as a utopia?
So we're going to do every idea that we ever had in 5 weeks. You know, it's like, don't say we didn't have any ideas, you know?
Ideas galore, coming up on Cross Currents. Florida teen Trayvon Martin was unarmed when he was shot and killed by a neighborhood watch volunteer this past February. His case enraged many around the country, and it drew intense national attention to the Neighborhood Watch Program. The idea behind the group is simple. Neighbors are trained by the city to patrol the streets and report any signs of a crime. In Oakland, as crime rates have gone up, so have the number of neighborhood watches, from 300 to 800 in the past few years. But with the Martin case capturing the national headlines, questions are being raised about what a watch member's responsibilities really are and who's keeping watch over the watchers. KALW's Emily Gaddick reports.
I waved at somebody going by. It's friendly, but also it lets people know that we're watching.
It's around 10 o'clock on a brisk spring morning in the Oakland Hills, and I'm walking on Davenport Avenue with Danny Cialoa and Esther Fong. They're members of the Davenport Neighborhood Watch. Cialoa and Fong are wearing bright orange vests with a watch logo and carrying cell phones in case they need to snap a picture or call for help. They're looking for...
Oh, wait, just anything that's unusual. Even when I walked up and I saw you sitting there, I kind of took a look. Well, she looks... she looks like she belongs here.
Things out of the ordinary, especially cars driving by slowly. Young men especially, out of their cars walking.
Both Cialoa and Fong have been involved in the watch for decades. It's changed over the years. What was once just community meetings and volunteers walking the neighborhood has grown to include a blog, a listserv, plans to install cameras, and pay patrollers.
When you think about neighborhood watch, it truly is watch in many senses of the word. Trying to be watchful without being intrusive, and being watchful without being paranoid.
We're high enough in the hills that most of the bungalows have a view of the San Francisco skyline. But we're also just blocks from the junction of 580 and 13, close enough that you can hear the rush of traffic. That closeness has made the neighborhood a target for home invasions.
Hey, Dada. Doing well, thank you. Can we come over and say good morning? Do you have 30 seconds or you can come over here? How you doing, friend?
How you doing today?
Cialoa and Fong greet a neighbor they know as Dada. He points up the block at a house that was broken into recently.
And the very next day after that break-in, we had a guy come, burgundy car, discolored bumper. He came right back, real slow. He seen me, he backed up, waved, and there's another guy in the seat, the passenger seat, all the way back. I said, okay, I was right on time for you. So they left.
The break-ins on Davenport are part of a citywide trend in Oakland. As the police department is squeezed by budget cuts and layoffs, rates for serious crimes like burglary, robbery, and homicide have risen more than 20% over the last year. So civilians are increasingly taking responsibility for the safety of their own neighborhoods.
Lots of different neighborhoods in Oakland are in my district, and I'm seeing neighborhood watches pop up in all parts of my district.
That's Oakland Councilmember Libby Schaff. She represents a stretch of Oakland from the Montclair Hills to the High Street Corridor. She's a former watch captain. And now that she's in office, she promotes neighborhood watches in her district.
Neighborhood watches are not just a crime prevention tool. They are an improvement to your quality of life. You know, you do get connected to your neighbors, and that makes your experience living in an Oakland neighborhood better. You feel more comfortable, you know, knocking on your neighbor's door to borrow a cup of sugar. And other things, you know, babysitting, just block parties. They serve so many purposes in addition to just crime prevention.
East Oakland feels a lot different from the Oakland Hills. The neighborhood is denser. Many people live in apartment buildings. And it has a reputation as a hotspot for violent crime. but it's only recently that residents like Marlon McWilliams have started organizing watches of their own. In 2010, his new barbershop on 98th and Eads was broken into twice.
Both times my shop was broken into, the first time I had to go find an officer, you know, because it was a cold call. It was low priority. You know, second time, you know, nobody came for a day, you know, and nobody came to my business. I'm a business owner, chair in Neighborhood Watch, area representative. I had the police chief's phone number in my phone, area captain's number in my phone. I'm an elected official, all these things, and I couldn't get somebody to come out to come take a report from me.
He says it was made worse because his neighbors were reluctant to report crimes.
And to make reports or to be eyewitnesses for any number of reasons. You know, you want to be labeled. You don't want, for fear of retaliation or for fear of the unexpected and unknown.
The watch, he says, has helped change that. It makes them feel empowered.
And I think that people are getting to a point now where they are comfortable with stepping up, comfortable with, you know, being a resource and also being eyes and ears and not being worried about repercussion.
McWilliams says he deliberately kept the watch as simple as possible when he started it. Unlike the watch on Davenport, there aren't any plans to organize patrols and listservs or install cameras. Instead, neighbors text each other when they see anything suspicious.
More so than anything, it's just people living their life but being more attentive as to what's going on around them. We don't want to put anybody in harm's way or in jeopardy. We don't want anybody thinking that they're the police. We don't want anybody thinking that they're, you know, any vigilante justice or anything like that. We just want people to be attentive to what is possibly happening and be attentive to their surroundings and their neighbors.
Watch groups have faced more scrutiny since watch member George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black teen in Sanford, Florida. So far in Oakland, there haven't been any reports of such violent confrontations. But in a city where police response times have slowed and tensions over race and crime can run high, there are worries about watch volunteers taking too much responsibility, which is not what it's supposed to be about.
The Neighbor Watch program nationwide is really about people reporting and observing what's happening in their neighborhood.
That's Felicia Verdin, who helps train and oversee the roughly 800 active watches for the city. Anyone who's interested can form a group by contacting her office and holding just a single meeting a year. The city connects watch members with local patrol officers and teaches them how to spot and report suspicious activity.
I hear stories where people get in their car and they follow people, which we don't recommend or encourage at all, but I've heard people say that. Mm-hmm. We never, ever advocate anyone going out and going after suspicious people or carrying weapons. And we want people to stay safe. That's the most important thing, is that we want people to stay safe in their community.
This is my walking partner. Hi!
On patrol again with the Davenport Watch, we've circled the neighborhood and are standing back in front of Danny Cialoa's house. Everyone's a little out of breath after an hour hiking up and down the Oakland Hills. We didn't spot anything suspicious, no crimes in progress. Cialoa looks pleased.
It's not just watching crime. It's all of the social interactions that take place that allow us to care more for each other.
Maybe the basic act of keeping watch seems too simple a solution to the city's rising crime rate. But for watch members, it's more than that. It's a step towards building stronger communities. In Oakland, I'm Emily Gaddick for Cross Currents.
If you live in Oakland and are interested in starting a neighborhood watch, contact Neighborhood Watch Coordinator Brenda Ivey at 510-238-3091. You can find that number again at our website. It's klw.org. And you can share your thoughts with us about neighborhood watches at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Again, that number is 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Stereotypes or broad assumptions made about a group of people can easily feed degrading comments, especially when they have to do with race or ethnic origin. That's one of the topics at the art installation Question Bridge, Black Males at the Oakland Museum of California. We've partnered with the museum to share these perspectives. In our next installment, New York-based filmmaker Eternal Polk was brave enough to ask his black male peers about the topic of stereotyping.
This may seem like a silly question, but I want to know, am I the only one who has a problem eating chicken, watermelon, and bananas in front of white people?
I don't have a problem with it, period.
No, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't even eat watermelon because of the connotations that it has around black people. But I will eat some chicken, though.
I never heard the bananas one. I never heard bananas, really? Huh.
I don't know if you're the only one, but it is not a problem for me to eat whatever I want to eat in front of anybody.
You're not the only one, brother, to be honest. Every time, I still eat chicken. I eat a lot of watermelon, and I love bananas. But I'm always looking over my shoulder, wherever I'm at, seeing who's watching me eat this watermelon and this piece of chicken and this banana, always. You're not the only one.
No, I know plenty of African Americans who, as a rule, will not eat watermelon in front of white folks. Now, for me, I have difficulty relating to the question only in the sense that I've never ever liked watermelon and I don't eat meat. So I don't find myself in the situation where chicken and watermelon comes to a head. But I do know that there are times where you feel like you are the stereotype because, you know, if they say, hey, do you want to go play some basketball? And of course I love basketball. I played it every single day. But there's a part of me that wants to say, no, I don't want to play any basketball. What makes you think I want to play basketball? But in those moments, I think we have to be honest with ourselves and just know that there are some things that are true. Yes, you know, we like chicken, we like watermelon, and there's nothing wrong with that, and it's nothing to be ashamed of.
It's not a silly question, brother. My family sells 50,000 pounds of watermelons every week in the streets of South Chicago, Milwaukee, and Gary, Indiana, and have been since 1953. And we're okay with that. And by the way, I like fried chicken. In fact, I'm going to make some tonight.
I don't know if you're the only one ashamed. I'm not ashamed, but I do give chicken a second thought sometimes, even when I mention it, but I always pass it off as sort of like in a jokey joke way, because I do love chicken. Watermelon, I don't eat watermelon so much, so I'm not really so much ashamed of it. Bananas, I hadn't thought about bananas because I always think about a banana because I'm gay in a sexual way. So when I peel a banana, I'm always self-conscious in front of anybody just because sexuality, but not because of race.
I think really that question leads to a deeper question. Why are we so concerned with what they think about us? That's what the real question is. I don't really care. You know, I know somewhere in there I do care, but in my consciousness and what I'm going to say is I don't really care what they think. You know, I don't need their approval in order for me to go ahead and be me or in order for me to do my job, you know, or in order for me to be who I'm going to be. I don't need their approval. I don't need their job. None of that. You know, I think it's really important that we stop worrying about what they think and start worrying about what you think about yourself and maybe what the little black kid next door to you thinks about you. F*** some white person thinking what they think about you eating a watermelon or anything else, your shoes, your jacket, your hat backwards. I don't go with the sagging pants, but, you know, whatever you're doing, it's because it's your cultural identity or your food or whatever. What they think about is not really important.
You just heard from Delroy Lindo, Rich Cockrell, Charles Hollins, Abel Habtegiorgis, Julian O'Connor, Corey Baylor, Caleb Lindsay, and Danny Simmons. The Question Bridge Black Males art installation is up at the Oakland Museum of California through Friday, July 8th. It was put together by African-American artists Chris Johnson and Hank Willis Thomas in collaboration with Biate Ross Smith and Kamal Sinclair. For more information, you can go to questionbridge.com or find links at kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that aims for perfection. There's talk that we're in the midst of a second tech boom in San Francisco. Twitter is opening its new headquarters in the Central Market District, and residents are buzzing about what's to come. Mayor Ed Lee has been courting startups since he came into office, hoping they'll bring thousands of new jobs to the city. But many contend there's an unwanted side effect. The boom has been pushing up already high rent and property values, and it's threatening to push out many low-income residents living downtown. For now, Mid-Market is still something of a sore point for City Hall, dotted with abandoned storefronts and adult theaters. It's been that way for generations, as noted 3 years ago by then-Mayor Gavin Newsom.
I think I'm the sixth mayor since I have lived in San Francisco that's promised to do something about the Mid-Market. I know I won't be the last, but I don't want to look back and say I woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Neither does a group of local artists who say now it's their turn to present a vision for the city. But instead of making art to attract people to the neighborhood, they're focusing on the community that's already there and inviting them to participate in a large-scale exhibition called Streetopia. It launched on May 18th, and KALW's Martina Castro was there.
By a certain age, most of us come to accept the world as it is. If we're lucky, it's a pretty even balance between the good and the bad. Some things are bad. Road rage, war, poverty. And some are good, like best friends, family, and puppies. Many of us are resigned to accept this balance in our own lives and in the world, even if we're not that happy about it. But what if we set that aside for a minute and let ourselves wonder? What if it could just be the good? What would that world look like?
Lots of green, like jungle, like green, and like healthcare, housing, and food on demand.
People would have their own space that they need for living and working.
Like where you can just sit and, you know, and have like a bottle of red wine with you, like, you know, like you do in Italy or something.
Radical free art and expression, and a constant renewing celebration of freedom that stops only short of impinging on other people's rights. And otherwise is completely unfettered.
Does it look something like this?
Yeah, it looks a lot like this.
This is Streetopia. It's part exhibit, part festival, an event that brings together more than 130 artists, writers, activists, and other San Franciscans to imagine a utopian version of their city. Its home base is the Luggage Store Gallery on 6th and Market Streets, but it extends throughout the neighborhood over the course of 5 weeks. On opening night, the Luggage Store is packed with people winding in and out of a temporary mini-city. Every nook and cranny is home to some artistic representation of life as it should be. This exhibit is here for the duration of Streetopia, but the calendar includes events like a lecture series.
Communes were about solving problems. They were not about escape.
Documentary screenings.
Fantasy and science fiction present an alternative to the world as we know it.
And a perfectly sane man reciting poetry for 72 hours straight as he roams the streets of San Francisco.
It's the labor strike waterfront where the ships Santumo and Cosmos once sailed from Uruguay.
It's like that sort of quest for that utopian thing that's just up ahead, you know? It kind of like drew more and more people in, and it maybe like inspired me to like go further and further and push harder and harder and find ways to like make it as epic as possible.
That's Eric Lyle, one of the curators behind Streetopia, what has become this philosophical, fantastical, and radically creative search for utopia, which he thinks is very San Francisco.
People come here to find a freer self, you know, whether they're artists or whether they're queer people or whether they're political activists, or they look to this place as a as a place where they can come and be a part of this rich tradition. And of course, oftentimes when they get here, the thing that they're looking for is gone. You know, they're like, oh, there's no more beat poets, there's no more punk rockers, the Castro is gentrified, you know, etc. But by looking for those things, by coming here and looking, they continue to, it's like by looking for it, you make it.
Lyle and his friends are driven by this. In fact, when I ask him for his vision of utopia...
For me, it's the search. Yeah, I think that's the best part.
Lyle embarked on something very similar to Streetopia back in 2001 at the tail end of the dot-com boom.
We were feeling like we had no space. We were losing community space and housing very rapidly to gentrification. And people were in despair about that, but we wanted to come together and talk about what are we for and not what we're against.
So he and some friends took over an abandoned building at 949 Market Street. There they put together a bunch of exhibits and developed a huge following.
It was so ambitious and so well done and well organized and professional that no one could imagine it was illegal. And we did it for 4 months.
A decade later, Lyle and artists Chris Johansson and Cal Spelatich are at it again. One thing is different. Now they're in a leased space. But Lyle says something else is almost exactly the same.
You know, and I don't mean to pick on dot-com people. I mean, most of them are young, creative people that are, many of them are progressively minded and are interested in certain causes. But I feel like the infrastructure of the actual companies, you know, where you have these companies providing private bus services for their employees and stuff like that, it's like the engagement is not with the greater good. You know, like you have... It's more of a gated community kind of feel. Things are becoming more and more exclusive. So you're really losing, like, a sense of, like, I mean, what is a city, right?
It's cyclical. And I think right now in the city we're coming up against the challenge of, an influx of money and how we shape the city.
Ivy McClelland was with Eric Lyle at 949 Market Street in 2001.
As we see, there's all kinds of new building projects and, you know, high-tech companies coming in, and there's this massive influx of new residents. So, you know, us who've been here for a long time and have been drawn to the Bay Area, which is known for people seeking out utopian visions and living differently. We're just trying to find a way to have a dialogue with those who may not understand the legacy of the Bay Area.
That legacy is what inspired the Streetopia Free Cafe, where McClelland is preparing fresh food for a line of hungry visitors. It's in the luggage store annex in the Tenderloin neighborhood, just a few blocks north of Market Street.
There's going to be a wish list on the bulletin board.
Curator Eric Lyle says the original inspiration for the Free Cafe is the 1960s guerrilla theater group, the Diggers.
Who used feeding people as a practical political objective to take care of their own community through self-determination, but also had a performative aspect to it because, by feeding visibly in public, they were showing that their community has strength and that they could do things that the government infrastructure was failing to do.
Northern California was a magnet for, quote, intentional communities back then. Places with names like Morningstar, The Hog Farm, and Black Bear Ranch. In a Streetopia lecture, Jesse Drew talked about his experiences there and the hopes they had for changing the world.
The first one in everyone's list, you're going to laugh, curbside recycling, was the number one most brought up thing. In Utopia, there will be recycling for everybody, mandatory, to your door. I think that was really funny because if that is the case, then we won a few years ago, so we can all just go home.
Drew said many free community health clinics that we have today came out of the commune movement, as did the concept of sustainable living. Today, in many ways, sustainability has been commodified. It feels expensive to live in an environmentally and socially responsible way. And somehow, the people who can't afford to make any changes are often left out of the conversation.
Do you live here in the neighborhood or around here?
Exist here. I wouldn't call it living.
Oh, you exist here. Okay.
I have this problem. I'm allergic to pain, and this is like the most painful place I've ever been.
Back at the Free Cafe, I meet Alan Moore, as he serves himself a plate of hot food. He came to San Francisco in 1977, and he lives in the Tenderloin. In between friendly jokes, he makes it clear that he does not see utopia on the streets of his neighborhood.
This is my vision of hell. If I go to hell, I'm going to go to this exact same place. They're going to say, oh, you weren't good. You got to start all over again. Back to the Tenderloin, back to 77, back to slave wages, back to crack dealers, 300 to the corner, back to police who don't see the crack dealers and write people jaywalking tickets. Have you seen all this?
Yes.
I think I'm hallucinating. You're the only one who's seeing this. This couldn't be real.
So I'm walking on a stretch of Leavenworth down in the Tenderloin of San Francisco, and these six or so blocks between the Luggage Store Gallery on Market and 509 Ellis Street in the Luggage Store Annex is included in the Streetopia exhibit. There's a lot of people sitting on the sidewalks, hanging out on stoops. I saw at least two drug deals happening and several people using drugs. It's just, it feels neglected. And it's something you see on people's faces as well. They kind of wear it in their eyes.
Like everyone else, there's moments of despair and bitterness and cynicism. And there's part of me that also thinks, oh, utopia, what a ridiculous idea. Why are we even talking about that?
Micah Bezant is one of the Streetopia artists at the Luggage Store Gallery. Bezant says difficult times are when it's most important to have a clear vision of your utopia.
I think of it not as a fixed, concrete thing that we're ever going to reach where there are going to be no problems, but as a practice and a way to maintain balance with our despair.
One of my favorite authors, Eduardo Galeano, once wrote, "Utopia is on the horizon. I move two steps closer, it moves two steps further away. I walk another 10 steps, and the horizon runs 10 steps further away. As much as I may walk, I'll never reach it. So what's the point of utopia? The point is this, to keep walking." In San Francisco, I'm Martina Castro for Cross Currents.
The Streetopia exhibit will continue through June 23rd. You can find links to a full schedule of upcoming events at our website, klw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our stories and subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Artyom's Kunahoffs, Audrey Dilling, Erica Mu, Stephen Short, Isaac Silk, Ashley Ann Kriegbaum, and Chris Hoff. Today's show was engineered by Seth. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Cross Currents theme music is by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. And thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. Also, thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. What's this you're hearing? It's Black Cobra. They'll be on stage at Slim's in their hometown of San Francisco this Saturday with three other bands. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.